This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This hour, we're going to be tackling diseases, new ways to treat them, how to prevent them from becoming pandemic. We're even going to dip into the Wayback Machine to 1994. And we begin with HIV, the virus responsible for AIDS. 35 million people worldwide are living with HIV or AIDS, according to the World Health Organization. HIV still does not have a cure, but antiretroviral therapies have been a welcome tool in the treatment of the virus, and work continues at looking for ways to prevent transmission. You may have heard of Truvada. Two studies presented this week at a conference in Boston look at another possible HIV preventative. Here to tell us about the story and a few other picks this week is Azine Gureishi. She's a science reporter for BuzzFeed News here in New York. Welcome. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about it. A preventable, this drug makes it a preventable stateside?
Right. So, as you said, right now all we have, and I mean, it's an amazing tool, but all we have is the daily pill Truvada, which works, you know, upwards of 92% of the time in preventing the transmission of HIV. But scientists are looking for obviously more tools in the toolkit for prevention to sort of tackle the epidemic altogether. So this is adding, this is two studies which are looking at the possibility of using a vaginal ring. It's much like the contraceptive NuvaRing to prevent HIV transmission in women specifically. So it's a silicone ring and you put it in once per month. And it should offer protection.
Works? Does it work? Yeah.
Well, so this looked at 5,000 women in five African countries, and it uses this drug, dapivirine, that prevents HIV from being able to replicate. And it sort of worked. It's certainly optimistic results, but both of the studies had roughly 30% lower rates of transmission, which is admittedly not great.
Yeah.
But when they took out the sort of the younger women from the study, they interestingly saw that prevented transmission roughly 60% of the time. So they're still figuring out. There are plenty of follow-up studies to do to figure out exactly what's going on here and how effective this could be. But they do think that it probably boils down to how well people were using it.
There was a case of a patient on Truvada contracting HIV.
Right. So this also came out of this conference this week in Boston, which it's the first ever case of someone who is taking the daily pill and still contracted the virus. And the reason is because he actually came into contact with a virus that was resistant to both of the drugs in Truvada. And the reason for that is that, you know, the drugs that we're using for on the prevention side right now are the same drugs we're using on the treatment side. So there can be that crossover. HIV is a very clever virus.
And, yeah, well, one case, we'll have to wait for a few more, I think.
Yeah,
to get
no
little
cause for worry yet.
Yeah. We've heard now that climate change is affecting coral reefs. We have known about that, but now there's a new study giving out more proof about that?
Yeah, so this is a new one. It was published in Nature, and it's the first experimental evidence in the natural reef environment showing that rising CO2 emission rates are taking a toll on coral reefs. So scientists from Stanford used this alkaline substance to basically alter the pH in a small patch of the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia. And this changed the pH to pre-industrial levels. And they showed that the rate of the coral grew actually increased by roughly 7%. So the ocean acidification that we've seen as a byproduct of rising CO2 emissions has very likely slowed.
Wow. And this is not them saying, hey, let's just sprinkle baking soda all over the ocean and raise the pH a little more and get the corals to grow back. But it's just a proof of concept.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, as seawater is becoming more acidic, it can slow or even dissolve the calcium carbonate shells of coral. And we're already seeing that oceans are roughly 30% more acidic than in the pre-industrial revolution times. So the scientists were saying if the current trends continue, we might see corals shift into a permanent state of decline by the middle of this century, which is terrifying.
I already know scuba places. I've been scuba diving for almost 40 years. The coral's gone.
Oh,
I
God.
Go back to the places and the coral is gone. Let's move on to something a little more hopeful, and that is NASA. This is interesting. NASA put out an open sort of a casting call for astronauts, and the deadline closed last week, and they had tremendous response?
Yeah, so apparently people are getting more and more into the idea of space travel because more than 18,300 people applied to be in NASA's 2017 astronaut class, which has 14 openings. So this is the three times the number of people that applied last time they put out an open call, which is in 2012. And it's way more than their previous record of 8,000 applicants in 1978. And yeah, applications opened in mid-December. They closed last Thursday. And they're going to announce who the winners are, basically, in mid-2017. And, you know, the qualifications are pretty broad, which is probably why so many people applied. You just need to have a STEM bachelor's degree and, like, 3 years of experience in the field or 1,000 logged hours of piloting jet craft. But it's probably the case that way more people besides that applied who just wanted to be astronauts.
Yeah, and obviously they're not looking for those citizen passengers anymore.
Yeah, I think that, you know, at this rate, 0.08% of the applicants are going to be accepted, so you're going to have to be pretty damn good. But yeah, there's a lot of speculation as to why so many applied. And, you know, it was a big year for space. We had the Pluto flyby.
Yeah.
The Martian came out.
Great stuff. I wonder what that interview is going to be like.
Very unnerving.
How are you going to impress the person over the other 18,000 people?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
No idea.
let's go on to finally, scientists. This is kind of interesting. They have uncovered the ancient ancestor of the armadillo.
Yeah.
And it's not a tiny little animal.
No, not at all. So this is a new study published this week, and it confirmed that this family of ancient animals called glyptodonts are the long-lost relatives of armadillos. So they looked at a specific species called Dedicurus. It's also armored, but instead of, like, the modern-day armadillo, the plates that you see is one complete plate.
Right.
But the biggest difference is that they were about the size of a car, and they have these spiked club-like tails that they probably used in pretty intense combat, they're guessing. The last of the Dedicurus died about 11,000 years ago, so they had to basically excavate pieces of DNA from a 12,000-year-old fossil and reassemble this mitochondrial DNA. And they showed that the subfamily probably diverged about 35 million years ago. This is 30 million years before the development of the modern armadillo, before it emerged. And at the time, it was closer to 13 pounds, so it really evolved a lot in the course of its long stay here on Earth.
Described as the size of a Volkswagen.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things are described as the size of a... But that's a big big armadillo.
That is a big armadillo with a very big spiked club tail.
Stay away. Thank you, Azeem.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Azeem Gureishi is a senior science reporter for BuzzFeed News here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And if you watch the evening news, the drug ads are everywhere.
Ask your healthcare provider for two.
Talk to your doctor about prescription side effects.
Ask your doctor about Lyrica.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your pharmacist for Flomax.
Ask your doctor about Intermix.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor about Nasonex.
Ask your doctor about Lyrica and RLS.
Ask your doctor, of course, is preceded by a huge list of warnings and potential side effects that, like half the length of the commercial. It's called direct-to-consumer drug advertising, DTC. And it's been running in the U.S. for decades and has been controversial that whole time. And now a legislator has introduced a bill calling for limits on the practice. Joining me now to talk about the potential side effects, get it, is Ed Silverman. He writes the PharmaLot blog for Stat. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
All right, what are the good things about these ads?
Well, they can raise awareness. There are people who may not necessarily connect the dots and realize they have a condition or some disease that says they should take treatment and perhaps call their doctor and maybe discuss the problem. Whether that leads to discussion of a medication is a related but somewhat separate issue. So there's a benefit there because people might have an opportunity to pursue something they otherwise ignore.
Mm-hmm. And so the bad thing is?
Well, the contention is that in prompting people to do that, they may be unnecessarily contacting their doctor, and as part of the discussion, also insist or inquire and maybe insist on getting a particular medicine that they don't need, or maybe a medicine that simply isn't appropriate for what they're discussing. So, and as an outgrowth of that, the contention also is that most of the medicines that are advertised are newer medicines that cost more money than older, certainly generic medicines. So as a result, consumer healthcare costs may go up.
Aren't we one of the very few countries in the whole world that allow these ads?
One of two, the other being New Zealand.
Wow. So that is one of two. And last year, didn't the AMA, the American Medical Association, call for a ban on these direct-to-consumer ads?
Right. Unlike the congressional lawmaker who wants a three-year moratorium on advertising, the AMA wants an outright ban, which is a much higher bar, as you can imagine, to achieve. But they're pursuing it nonetheless.
So why would a group that represents the doctors want to ban this?
Because the doctors feel too often consumers, patients, come into their offices and start talking about medicines they may not need, as I mentioned a moment ago. And they feel pressured to write the prescriptions because in this environment, they may lose the patients and therefore lose some business if the patients are adamant, want a prescription, but the doctor doesn't comply and the patient feels frustrated and figures, oh, I have a problem. I need to get that drug. I'll go to another doctor to get the prescription.
Yeah. And I've heard over the years, that because we have been talking about this for years, on the flip side, the drug companies will say, you know, if patients go in and ask their doctor for anything, maybe they, as you say, they might discover an illness they hadn't seen before.
Right. And that's legitimate. I mean, whether we're talking about our health, our houses, our cars, or anything else that we rely upon, we want to be informed. We want to know more. We want to connect dots. We want to be able to address issues if they exist and be able to do so in a proper fashion. So if you have more information, that can be a good thing. The question is, are we getting the right kind of information? Is there a balance between promotion and true scientific-based evidence? That's the crux of the debate.
Yeah, well, and this being the American drug and healthcare system, that debate will go on for a while. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
You too. Ed Silverman writes the PharmaLot blog for Stat. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to look back, go to the Wayback Machine to 1994 on Science Friday, play a little bit of that, because we're going to talk about the global diseases and pandemics. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. New cases of the Zika virus have become so common that you're hardly hearing anything breaking news about them. Although we're having new cases every day. Every week there's a new question. Can it be transmitted by sex? What's the link to microcephaly? What can the U.S. expect with mosquito season around the corner? But back in December of 1994, the headlines were a little bit different. Instead of Zika, think hantavirus. Remember that one? It struck the Southwest Four Corners in 1993, infecting dozens before cropping up again in New York in 94. And 1994 also brought plague, the poster child for infectious diseases. An outbreak in India back then killed 56, raising disturbing questions about our ability to combat diseases we thought we had already licked. The diseases change, but the questions stay the same. How do we detect outbreaks faster, develop cures, get them to the people who need them the most? Well, back in 1994, two public health experts came on our show to talk just about that. Lori Garrett was a health and science reporter for Newsday back then. She was out with a new book, The Coming Plague. Our second guest, Dr. Stephen Ostroff, then the CDC's Associate Director for Epidemiological Sciences. Well, with Science Friday celebrating our 25th year this year, we decided to check back in with our guests. What's changed in the era of Zika and Ebola? So here they are. Lori Garrett is the Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. She's here in our New York studio. Always good to have you back, Lori.
Hi, Ira.
Stephen Ostroff. Dr. Ostroff is the former acting commissioner for the FDA. I think it was that till yesterday. He joins us today from Washington. Welcome back, Dr. Ostroff.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Lori, I'm going to start with you. Looking back over the last 22 years, are you more struck by what's changed or by what stayed the same?
Well, I'm struck by what's changed in one way and what's stayed the same or gotten worse in another way. What has changed very dramatically is back in 1994 when Steve and I were on this show and when my book came out, it was a controversial premise the notion that we had not defeated infectious diseases, that they would surge back, that we were not comfortably in the age of just thinking about cancer and heart disease. That has completely changed. Mm-hmm. And I think now from the highest levels of government right on down, people realize that we had a major hubris problem back in the day and that the microbes are constantly mutating and posing new challenges. What frustrates me is that we continue to have, with every single outbreak, every single, you know, portent on the horizon, such as losing the efficacy of antibiotics and so on, we continue to have two trends that just constantly reemerge. One is government saying, let's kick that down the road. You know, we'll deal with it when it's in our face, but we don't really want to put time, energy, and money into it before catastrophe. And the second is that when catastrophe hits, the public goes berserk. And every single time, the conspiracy theorists come out of the walls, the people who claim government doesn't know what it's doing, and on and on and on. And the public health officials like Steve Ostroff have to fight the exact same battles in terms of public mm-hmm. opinion and mobilizing wacko politicians and so on over and over. And that's true in every country in the world. That's not a uniquely American sad phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
Let me go back to 1994. Let me go back to a piece of tape. Dr. Ostroff, back in 94, you warned us in no uncertain terms that antibiotic resistance was going to be a big problem.
I think that we have unfortunately squandered a wonderfully golden gift, which was given to us 50 or 60 years ago, and that was the gift of antibiotics. And I think many of us fear, as we approach the end of the 20th century, that we're getting into a situation where we went from the pre-antibiotic era to the antibiotic era to the post-antibiotic era.
Dr. Ostroff, are we in the post-antibiotic era?
Well, you know, I was certainly fascinated to hear that particular quote again, because when I said that, it was at a time where I don't think that there was a lot of attention being paid to the growing problems that we were seeing with antibiotic resistance. And, you know, if my memory serves me correctly, I know that several of the federal agencies a couple of years later put out a report about things that could be done to address the problem of antimicrobial resistance. And in fact, I know this was at the time I was at CDC, and I know that we updated that report a couple of years later, but the topic itself didn't really get a lot of attention or a lot of traction. But I think one of the things that has changed in recent years, particularly in the last couple of years, is the recognition that this is a really serious and growing problem, and that it has gotten to what I would refer to as the tipping point, where we really do have to pay attention to this. We have to devote significant resources to the problem, and we have to do something to reverse the trends that we've seen. And I think that even at the highest levels of government, you hear now President Obama talking about this. You hear leaders in Europe and the World Health Organization talking about that particular topic. So I'm very hopeful that with this recognition that there really is the potential, with appropriate investments of resources, to be able to do something about this.
But it's not the government that's going to make the antibiotics, right, Laurie? It's the corporations that are going
to
make
them. I want to share Steve's optimism, but we have two plasmids in circulation. You know, a plasmid is a little package of DNA. We have two in circulation that are now showing up all over the world in all kinds of different bacterial populations that combine universal antibiotic resistance. They render everything useless for bacterial attack. And, you know, when the first one emerged about 4 years ago in New Delhi, people said, well, you know, we have one case imported to the UK and the rest is in India. It's, you know, we got time for the industry to get mobilized and for somebody to figure out what to do. And that's now, as far as I know, everywhere in the world. It's called NDM1. We have another one that surfaced just recently in China, and it's already in like 30 countries. The problem is that the industry wants a home run with high profit potential immediately. What they're not interested in is replacing the old stalwarts or streamlining penicillin or coming up with better ways to package the off-patent drugs. Mm-hmm. And there aren't a lot of new targets that anybody's found that seem to make a lot of sense. The other problem is that every new, significantly new drug is exponentially more expensive than whatever predated it. And we're getting to the point where effectively we have untreatable bacterial infection for economic reasons already in much of the world because they can't afford the new drugs, even if they do come out.
Mm-hmm. Let's go move on to another bit of tape from in 1994. Laurie, when you warned us in 94 about cost cutting.
We have had enormous budget-cutting atmosphere in the United States, and some of the things that have been devastated have been those sort of routine public health programs like mosquito control, rat control. And these programs have taken huge slashes. According to the CDC's own studies, at the local level, at the state level, municipal level, we are in very bad shape in this country, and we should not be complacent. We should not sit back and think, oh, yeah, we have this great body, and if anything happens, they're going to move in and take care of the situation. That's not the state of affairs at this time.
What is the state of affairs this time?
Oh, now? God, goodness. You know, a couple things happened after that that have, in some ways, made matters much worse. And Steve was part of one of them. We had a little problem called anthrax mailings in 2001, and
right.
Steve was leading investigations here in New York. And one of the things that happened after that was a kind of securitization under the Bush administration, Bush W, of the CDC and of public health all across the country, with a huge skewing of expenditures and personnel towards being ready for anthrax, being ready for biological weapons, blah, 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 running drills. Every hospital in the country had, you know, here's the secret bioterrorist agent been released. Be prepared. Demonstrate mm-hmm. you can move the patients around and what have you. And in many states, many places I went, people bemoaned that in order to accommodate these federal mandates, they eliminated their mosquito control program. They eliminated their mammography and breast cancer awareness program. They eliminated their STD, sexually transmitted disease program, and so on. And at the local level, and you know, you have to remember that even though we have this great CDC, public health in America really is a local function.
First responders.
First responders. And at the local level, it's a big ouch.
All right. Stephen, would you agree that?
Well, I have to say, I think that Laurie has really hit the nail on the head, as she so often does. You know, one of the things that it's worth pointing out is that in between my latest job and when I left the CDC in 2005, I was actually working at the state level in Pennsylvania for a number of years. And so I've seen both sides of the equation. And while Laurie's correct that there are now considerably more resources available than there were back in 1994, we still suffer from a phenomenon of seeing large amounts of resources devoted to a problem while it's very highly visible and everyone is paying attention to it. But the difficulty tends to be sustaining those resources over time. And so, as Laurie mentioned with the anthrax episode, there was a large infusion of resources. We saw the same phenomenon when the pandemic H1N1 came along in 2009. For a while, we saw it with West Nile, and of course, the same occurred with Ebola. But the difficulty is once people's attention tends to fade and they turn to other problems, the resources tend to dwindle down as well. And one of the important lessons that you learn is that the same people who are dealing with each of those, or for each of those problems, it's the same people that are on the front lines trying to address them. And the important issue is making sure that we sustain the infrastructure that's necessary all the time, because as you know, these problems tend to come up over and over again, and I think that they will continue to do so.
Well, I'll tell you one that's coming right now. People tend to think, you hear the phrase mosquito abatement, and it sounds like boring, you know. But these are the folks that actually have the skill set to know how to not poison you, not put DDT on your front lawn, but stop those mosquitoes. We got Zika. It's lapping at our shores. We're in winter now, but as we go to summer, we're going to see all the proper populations of mosquitoes emerging across the southern United States. And you're going to find out that mosquito abatement, if it works, requires people that are there year after year after year. They have a skill set. You can't just pull a kid out of high school and say, go out and spray the bushes. And we will see which states have maintained mosquito abatement personnel and programs and which have done cutbacks, and then we'll pay a price with Zika as we get into summer.
So we're just playing sort of whack-a-mole.
Absolutely.
All the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the story of public health, whack-a-mole.
Yeah, I have to say, because West Nile was something I was very heavily involved in when it first arrived on our shores in 1999, and we did certainly have an infusion of resources over the next year or two to be able to address the infrastructure, even to monitor where the mosquitoes were, let alone have programs to be able to do mitigation. And over the next several years, those resources dwindled considerably. I wrote an article after an outbreak that had occurred in Dallas, Texas, a couple of years ago, and the title of that article was West Nile, Forgotten but Not Gone. And so I think one of the unfortunate consequences is that we're reaping the results of allowing that infrastructure that was put in place for West Nile to have deteriorated, and now we need it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if we can get some callers to call in. 844-724-8255 is our number. If you'd like to tweet us, you can also tweet us at SciFry. Here on Science Friday, talking with Laurie Garrett and Stephen Ostroff on, Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato. Let's go back to the Wayback Machine and get another clip. This was a caller named Jesus who asked us a very prescient question.
Is the CDC or the military have any plans for any sort of emergency that may develop, particularly with some of these viruses, including Ebola, which could be potentially quite nasty?
Talking about Ebola?
Yeah, that's a really prescient question, and one that I've devoted most of my adult life to trying to deal with. You know, what happened was when Ebola broke out about 3 or 4 months after we taped this, we were on the air, in 1995 in Kikwit, and I went to Kikwit and was in the middle of the epidemic for most of the duration of it, and came back and found that the government was quite disturbed and everybody was suddenly revved up and we need a plan. And then, of course, they forgot about we need a plan until after anthrax. Then they beefed up we need a plan again. That one was very biased towards bioterrorism and was forgotten after a while. And then in 2005, after we'd had the SARS epidemic around the world in 31 nations, and then H1N1, as Steve referred to, the swine flu, was looming in 2009. But 2005 was the turning point because a previously obscure bird flu mutated called H5N1.
Remember that.
And suddenly had the capacity to infect a wider range of birds and came into Europe and down into northern Africa. And the Bush administration became very distressed. I found myself briefing the National Security Council, the State Department, CIA, what are we going to do about this? And so the Bush administration put together a very, very detailed pandemic influenza plan. And for the first time, it was a plan that really linked to the international picture. So it didn't imagine sort of Fortress America being able to, I guess as Donald Trump would say, build giant walls to keep microbes out, or as Governor Christie would say, let's just quarantine them all. It was a plan that said our security is linked to what's going on everywhere in the world, and we have to help the poor countries of the world to build up their capacity to identify and respond to disease. Now, every government since has had permutations, and currently the Obama administration has the Global Health Security Initiative trying to bring all the countries in the world up to speed and we'll see if the Republicans will continue to support it.
My guests are Laurie Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, Stephen Ostroff, former Acting Commissioner at the FDA. Our number, if you'd like to call us, is 844-724-8255. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about it, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about pandemics and public health. What can past outbreaks teach us about protecting ourselves today? My guests are Laurie Garrett and Stephen Ostroff, and we're going to continue talking about the epidemic and look dip into our tapes from back in 1994. But first, I want to follow up on a conversation you may have heard on the show last week about the global effects of El Nino. Caller Hans in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, asked us this question.
Sorry, it's not really a health question, but I was just curious about, given where El Nino tends to start in the Pacific Ocean, if it has any sort of effect on the Hawaiian Islands.
Well, it turns out it was a health question. We didn't have an answer for Hans last week, but joining me now is Molly Solomon, a reporter at Hawaii Public Radio, and she's going to bring us up to date on the latest dengue outbreak in the state, Hawaii's third dengue outbreak in 15 years. Molly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ira. Happy to be here.
How many cases are we talking about now?
So I just checked, and currently, as of yesterday afternoon, there are 260 total cases of dengue fever in Hawaii right now. Right now, they're all on Hawaii Island. That's the big island of Hawaii. And about 90% of those are folks that live there, residents. About 25 or so are visitors that have come to the islands on vacation. But it has slowed in recent days or the last week or so. We've only had one case reported since last Friday.
You know, if there were 260 cases in any other state of the union, it'd be leading the news. We don't hear a thing about it here on the mainland.
That's right.
It's unbelievable.
And I'm sure a lot of folks here in Hawaii are a little disappointed that others don't know about the dengue outbreak that is going on right now.
Do we know how it arrived in Hawaii?
We do. So the outbreak that we're currently dealing with, it came from someone that was infected in another country. They came back to the islands. They probably didn't know that they had dengue fever. And then a local mosquito bit them. And that mosquito then became infected with dengue fever and went on to bite other people and sort of passing on the disease from there. And this actually happened in September of last year and sort of snowballed throughout the later end of the year and is still going on right now.
And how has the state responded?
So the state is doing a couple things. I think a lot of people, public opinion, felt that they were a little slow at first, but they have since ramped up efforts. You know, they've been spraying at homes and yards where folks that have been contaminated with the virus, they've sprayed in the areas where they've been seen as high risk in Kailua Kona. They shut down two beaches as well as a popular area called Waipio Valley. And I think the big problem with Hawaii Island is that it is one of the more rural islands. So you're dealing with a place that is very tropical. There's a lot of plants and areas that would be prime breeding sites for mosquitoes. So I think it's difficult for the state to deal with this, but especially I think because of something that you actually were talking about earlier is the cuts to vector control programs in local communities in different states. That's something that Hawaii has experienced. Back in 2009, they had cuts to their state's vector control program and it actually got gutted practically in half. So there were only 25 people versus 56, which is what they used to have. So I think that's had a pretty big effect in that the folks that are, you know, working to spray these areas, notify the public, they've been stretched pretty thin. They've been working, you know, 7-day weeks trying to get the information out.
Yeah, Laurie, you were briefing congressional staffers just this week.
Yes.
They had no idea.
They didn't know anything about it. They didn't know that there was a dengue outbreak in Hawaii, and I was saying to them, pay attention, because the reason Hawaii has had three rounds of dengue is because of the introduction of Asian mosquitoes to the Hawaiian Islands, not native to the islands, the Aedes albopictus. Now, we've had Aedes aegypti introduced to North America via slavery back 300 years ago, and then Aedes albopictus was introduced via the trade in recyclable tires, and the mosquitoes laid their larvae in the tires in Malaysia, and they ended up in Brazil. Well, we've been warning over and over again, and I'm sure Steve Ostroff can tell us wild stories about how hard it's been to get politicians to focus on this, but here's these dangerous mosquitoes. All you need, as happened in Hawaii, is one person showing up at the right time, the right temperature, the right weather conditions, getting bit. That mosquito goes and bites 10 other people, and boom, you start to have an outbreak. And so, you know, I was saying to the congressional staffers, we will have local transmission of Zika. It will happen. So start looking now. What do your mosquito abatement programs look like?
Well, Molly, thank you very much for letting the rest of the country know about what's going on in Hawaii.
Happy to do so. Thanks for having me on, Ira.
You're very welcome. Molly Solomon is a reporter at the Hawaii Public Radio, and she joined us today from San Francisco. Moving on, Dr. Ostroff, in 1994, going back, you could confidently say this. You could say this about vaccines.
When you talk about some of the childhood vaccines, I think that we've done a wonderful job in making sure that the children who need to get these vaccines actually get them.
Would you ever have predicted, Dr. Ostroff, the resistance we're seeing today to childhood vaccines in this country?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And I mean, I think that there's always been concerns about vaccines. I think that we have such better information and such better science to refute most of those concerns. What I will say is that we still have superb vaccination levels across the entire population in many of our children because of available programs. But what we don't have is we don't have consistent levels of vaccination throughout the country. And so we're faced with circumstances where there are pockets of under-immunization. And those pockets of under-immunization, unfortunately, leave many other people at risk of acquiring diseases where we thought we wouldn't see problems with them. And I think the poster child for this is the problems we've seen with measles in the past year or two, where back in 2000, measles was considered to have been eliminated from the Western Hemisphere. And yet we continue to have problems, and those problems occur because in the other part of the world, measles is not eliminated. And so all that has to happen is somebody either travels to that area or somebody from those areas travel to the United States and find those individuals who are under-immunized, and you spark these problems. And so I think that it is something that we have to continue to pay very close attention to, because these problems, I think, will continue to occur unless we have better ways of being able to get those who need to be immunized immunized.
Laura, here's something that you said about vaccines back in 94.
At this time in the world, there is no financial incentive whatsoever to vaccine manufacturers to make a vaccine that targets a microbe that primarily affects the developing world. At this time, there is every disincentive imaginable. They will not make any money off of it.
Now, though, you have some good news to tell us?
Well, yeah. I mean, a couple things have happened. One is the creation of Gavi, the Global Alliance of Vaccinators and Immunizers, which now has billions of dollars to spend every year, thanks in large part to Bill Gates and to David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the UK. This entity does a couple of things. One, it purchases massive quantities of vaccines and gets them to poor countries. That creates an incentive to industry. They know someone will buy the product, and so they continue to make them. And then just recently, when the Ebola vaccine was developed on site in the epidemic in West Africa, Gavi said to industry, we will put up a pot of gold right here if you go out and make this vaccine and build a stockpile and store it under proper conditions so that it will last for many, many years in case we need it in the future. And that shows that if you create the right incentive systems, you can have breakthroughs. The problem is that it still is the case that without special money like I was just describing, industry wants a home run in the pocketbook. And that means targeting Americans and Europeans, basically. And that limits a lot of the range of possibilities. Now, two big success stories of late. One, which was highly controversial in this country and continues to be controversial in certain political sectors of our society, the human papillomavirus vaccine, or HPV vaccine, just announced in studies published this week, 64% reduction in girls and women diagnosed with cervical carcinoma or pre-cervical carcinoma because of that vaccine. Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, the dividends down the road, not just in lives saved, but in cost to society for treatment and care of cancer. Fantastic. And then we just had published this week in Science Magazine a breakthrough study looking at two survivors from the 1995 Ebola epidemic in Kikwit, where the one I was in before I was also in the 2014 epidemic. And this they found in these two survivors that these individuals, all these years later, have extremely high levels of effective antibodies in their body that could be administered to rhesus monkeys and then inject Ebola live virus directly into those monkeys, and every one of the monkeys that was immunized survived and cleared the virus completely.
Amazing.
This is a spectacularly successful possibility, and if industry can be incentivized to develop both treatment and vaccine based on this, we could almost effectively say that Ebola is rendered a development issue, not a medical issue.
And as far as the link for Zika virus to microcephaly, is there any news on that?
Yes, there is. And that was just published today at 2 p.m. on PLOS. It is the discovery jointly by Yale University and a team in Brazil of a young woman who was pregnant and had a sonogram that showed her baby at 18 weeks was already malformed. They tracked this child all the way to stillbirth at 32 weeks, then conducted immediate autopsy. And they were able to demonstrate the fetus had microcephaly, had profound neurological issues, and they've discovered active virus in the child's brain tissue, central nervous system, and some other tissues in the body. I think that's a pretty big home run.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Laurie Garrett and Stephen Ostroff. A few minutes left. Stephen, are you hopeful? More hopeful than you were 22 years ago?
Well, it's a really interesting question. You know, on the whole topic of emerging infectious disease, sort of my point of reference is a report that was issued by the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences actually in 1992, and it was the basis for some of the recommendations that were made by the CDC a year or two later about how to address these. But in that 92 report, there were six factors that were mentioned very specifically as being sort of the root causes of emerging diseases, and one of them was changing human demographics. One of them had to do with technologic changes that we ourselves do. Another one was changes in the environment. The fourth was travel and human movement. The fifth was microbial adaptation. And the sixth was failure to implement tried and true public health measures. And if you think about many of those factors, they are absolutely just as relevant today as they were back in 1992. And if you think about those trends in those various factors, many of them have gone in the direction that favor the microbes. And so I don't think that we should have the same levels of hubris that you started out the segment with about the end of the era of infectious diseases, because I do think that we will continue to see events of the type that we've seen over the last few years. And that's why it is so critically important to keep the infrastructure in place so that we can address these. One of my favorite quotes is that if you think prevention is hard, try response. And so we'd much rather be in a position where we can prevent some of these things from happening rather than just being in this continuous fire drill way of dealing with these.
Well, this being an election year, how do you raise this issue? How do you get it into the conversation?
Well, unfortunately, it's already been raised, but in the wrong ways. I mean, Chris Christie just before he actually stepped out of the campaign, said if asked, he would be happy to enforce quarantine to stop Zika, just as he did by isolating Casey Hickox, the nurse who returned from Sierra Leone and was negative for Ebola, but he kept her for 80 hours in a tent on the tarmac in Newark, New Jersey. We've already had Rand Paul, and all the candidates that are still on the GOP side have addressed the possibility of refusing vaccines, the notion that it's an individual right to say, no, I don't want to get vaccinated, I don't want to vaccinate my children, but I do want them to go to school with your kids and possibly give them measles. And we unfortunately see these issues come in the wrong way consistently in campaigns. And this is true not just this year, but every presidential round. They enter more in a reactive way than.
So what would be the right way?
Well, the right way is to talk about what is the nature of a health infrastructure, and also say to de-link emerging diseases from immigration. There's no evidence at all that we face diseases because of immigrants. We face diseases because of global trade, travel, and globalization, which are essential to our economy. We can't suddenly say we won't go overseas anymore. We have to figure out much more creative ways and ways that involve international solidarity instead of international divisiveness and hatred to combat shared risk and provide shared benefits. And that's the real challenge point we're at right now, is that much of the world doesn't trust us. They don't trust Americans. They think we're a bunch of lying scumbags on this issue. I guarantee you I hear it over and over again, because they will say, every time a new disease occurs, you guys get all the vaccines. You guys get all the drugs. And then you come to us and say, build an infrastructure to protect. You just want yourselves protected. Mm-hmm. You don't care if we die.
You've got the last word on that. Laurie Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. You'll notice she does not mince her words when she speaks. Stephen Ostroff is the former acting commissioner of the FDA. I want to thank you both for joining me today.
Well, it was terrific to be with you.
We'll check back in 2038. How about that?
All right.
All right. Special thanks special thanks to listener Sherry Gallo, who tipped us off to the dengue outbreak in Hawaii. Thanks, Sherry. And if you want more from the Sci-Fi Archives, earlier this year we looked at the future of personal computing from 1993 to today. And you can listen to what's changed at sciencefriday.com/computing. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.